Accession number 11938, reel 38.
Mr. G. Iston, reel 38. You mentioned in this battle with the composite battalion, Mr. Iston, that there were communication problems. Was this still a factor at this stage of the war?
Yes. We had two wireless sets, and they both went on the blink. Now, that was not unusual, and it's possible that it was a good thing in a sense, because at this time, we just discovered that why Rommel always was up forward with his troops. He was up there because of a special unit for listening in to wireless messages. He'd had a name, but I just can't remember the name. We had one, it was called Ultra, as far as I remember, which did a similar thing. But this was, he was listening to conversations between the forward troops and their commanders. And of course, with this system, he knew the situation before our brigade commander knew what the situation was. So therefore, he was able to jump the gun on a lot of occasions. And this probably was the cause of a lot of trouble at Gazala. That with this listening system that he had, he could listen to the wireless sets and form his opinion before the brigade commander or the divisional commander knew what was happening. And we just discovered this, so possibly the fact that we didn't have the wireless sets wasn't as big a disadvantage as we anticipated. If the runners had got through, that might have been that would have been okay. You see, the wireless sets in those days, they were medium wave, and if the conditions were right, it meant the signal could travel a long way. Not like today, where you've got a telephone with a signal of 100 metres. I mean, in the right conditions, a radio telephone, I should say, you can have it cut down so its radius is 100 metres from its main signal. But with these, if the conditions were right, they could travel for miles. I mean, they were intended to travel for about 2 miles. But if the conditions were right, they could travel to 10 or 20 miles. And this unit of Rommel's was picking the signals up and decoding them. And, well, they took no decoding because a lot of the forward troops always worked in open language. There was no coding about it. We had code names, but apart from that, it was open speech, more or less.
What was the problem with the kind of sets that you had? Because they seemed to appear to break down so often.
Well, we're still working with valves. And over a bit of rough country, a valve could go at any time. And by the time you got the valve changed, the urgency had gone out the situation in most cases. They're old-fashioned. They were modern then. I mean, they were just coming into the field. Now, funny enough, the tanks were the... I can't remember the numbers now. I think we had the number 9 set in the infantry, and the tanks had 19 sets. But they were only sort of a troop commander of the tank, and the squadron commander of the tank had a wireless set. So they were very, very scarce, not like today where practically, well, every tank was in communication with somebody. A lot of them carry two sets now, one for the troop conversation and one for the squadron conversation.
In your situation, where you may be travelling in column at the back and stop to... do something with a broken down vehicle. Did you have a wireless on your side?
No. I don't even think the MTO had one. No, I don't think he had one. I think company commanders, the CO, one in battalion headquarters, the adjutant, and that was about it. Maybe 5 or 6 sets in each battalion, and they were operated by signals in those days. They hadn't got even down to where nowadays I believe a section commander has one on his back, and he talks direct with his platoon commander, and it goes on and on. But they were, in today's thinking, they were old-fashioned. They were great while they were working, but of course Montgomery, Rommel had cottoned onto this in France, you see, probably in Poland, where he cottoned onto it, that he could pick up signals from a distance. And he knew what other people were thinking, and they could set his stall out to fit the situation. The British had a similar listing system, and we thought it was entirely ours at the time, and we used the intelligence to go with it. And in fact, the British ultra system, did prove superior to Rommel's.
Were you aware of this at the time?
It was just coming in.
You knew about it?
We just got to know about it, and that was really why Colonel Battle's command worried too much when he only had two wireless sets. Now, if we'd had the three or four, I think Major Kirby would have got through, and Major Ovenden. It was Captain Major Ovenden and Captain Kirby at the time. It gets a bit mixed up because they went up further on. I think if they'd been had any communication at all, they'd have got through and they would have been able to defend the infantry. The infantry, you see, I think I did say it was going to be a silent one when it started. It was going to be a silent walk through. But at a later stage, I think it was decided they would try this barrage system out as a preliminary to the proper Alamein. And we were held up somewhere close to El Alamein station while loads and loads of 25 pounders went through and got themselves in position before we were allowed to go through. You see, the other brigade, 69th, was already there, and the Australians were already there, but we were one that was going to come in between those two, and then the three brigades were going to spread to make this wide, long front. Now, the infantry got in behind the barrage, and they had some problems because the minefield hadn't been done properly. I think I did mention that. The minefield hadn't been done properly, and the infantry ran through the minefield, and they did get on their positions. At that stage, I think that should have been about 2 o'clock in the morning, I can't just remember, I think it was about 2 o'clock, the S Company with the mortars and the anti-tank and... In fact, some of the tanks should have gone in at that stage. But the word never got through. He even sent two officers back to get the anti-tank brought forward. But it was just impossible. So now, one of the great hazards for anybody is to be in an attack and held up, hanging about. And we were there from, I think the attack went in somewhere around 8 o'clock, maybe, no, 10 o'clock I believe it was, that one went in. And we were hanging around from 10 o'clock at night until eventually about 4 o'clock the next day, still waiting to go forward all the time, thinking there was a problem and we couldn't get through. The problem was that as the barrage had lifted, you know, if a defensive people are well dug in, it's amazing the amount of shells that can stand. I explained about the bombing in the last tape. It's amazing how much shelling they can stand, and especially if they're on the fringe of the on the flanks of the shelling. And then of course they can come out and get the machine guns and fire on fixed lines. And of course the 88s, which are back in any case, they found the gap. They had the gap properly arranged, so they were shelling us all continued from the time the attack went in, because our artillery didn't go quite as far as the 88, so we've been shelled all the time. And then when the infantry went through, and of course these on the flanks, you see, they came out the funk holes or whatever, the dugouts or whatever they were in, and got on the fixed lines, and they were firing down no man's land, which more or less stopped anybody from getting through from the forward to the back or from the back to the forward, as far as we were concerned. Fixed lines, I'm not sure I'll explain that a little bit. With machine guns, the rangefinder and the section commander during daylight pick out various spots and they mark them. They get the direction and the range, and they plant a little lamp on the front and generally to the right hand side of them, of the gun, just a few feet in front of the gun and slightly to the right, with a light in, just a little like a bullseye. And they take the range and the direction and lay the gun onto the spot, and then they leave the gun on the spot and switch their dials round until they are laid onto the light in front. Then that's recorded. So the code name, you've got to say B12, range 1,500 yards, right 150 degrees. And then at night, if B12 is in trouble, all they've got to do is to put the figures on the dials, one for elevation and one for direction, point the sight to the light, and the gun is laid on B12. And they've got these on maybe a dozen spots all the way down the field of fire. Now, if they want to, normally, with the Vickers in any case, you used to tighten the clamps up till one smack of your right hand, or your left hand, preferring which way you wanted to go, moved it about 5 degrees. So if you were on B12, you smacked it to the right, you came 5 degrees off B12. If you smacked to the left, you went 5 degrees to the left of B12. Now, with a machine gun again, you would think it would shoot like a bullseye. In fact, it doesn't. I forget the exact figures now, but I think the machine gun fires like an eclipse, which is 2 points lengthways from the gun, 100 feet, and about 15 feet either side of the... This is the slack in the gun. There's bound to be a slack, for all it seems perfectly tight. And when you're erecting the gun, it is tight, but it is amount of slack in the gun. So you've got an eclipse, a field of fire, which is like 100 feet deep and 15 feet either way. So if you take 5 degrees across, you just come to the edge of that thing, you've still got your 100 feet length, and then you keep going on 5 degrees all the way through, and the gun is set to do that. And if you want to come back, I mean, they've got to remember that you've gone sort of three smacks to the right, you want the left three smacks to the left to come back again. So you can do that without looking at the sights. This is all, if you've got to go into another position, you must look through the sights again, put your dials right, and then you come back to your lamp. And night. This is fixed lines, machine guns.
When you smack, you're smacking what?
The handles. You've got, on the Vickers in particular, it had two handles, one each side, with a thumb button in the middle, which was the trigger. So you held it with, we'll say you're going to the right, you held it with your left hand with your thumb on the trigger. You fire 25 rounds, you learn a burst of 25 rounds. And then you lift your foot off the thumb off the trigger, give it a smack with the right hand, and that brings it over 5 degrees. And the same if you're going the other way. So you have a good idea where you're at. And I mean, every now and again, you've got to stop and just have a look at your light again to make sure that you're still on the right point. Normally, after you've done about, well, maybe 20 rounds, 20 bursts, you'll find you've got another target, and then you'll have to go set your dials again and switch to the next target, whichever one it is. But you see, after the barrage is gone and the infantry's gone forward, in this case in particular, and the S Company was supposed to come through and protect the flanks of the attack, the Germans came out with their phone calls onto the fixed lines, and they blocked it off. Simple as that, really.
Did you see any stragglers getting back?
Oh, there's quite a few. And before the barrage lifted properly, we had, I should think, 200 prisoners back. Quite a lot of prisoners. A lot gave themselves up. They'd had enough. They just gave themselves up. In fact, I believe there's one tank came across. I wasn't there, of course. This was the forward troops. I think there was a tank came across and just gave itself up. It had enough. This was the first real barrage. that had been used. Of course, I think it was a tryout for the Alamein barrage, which was to come later on.
You said that you waited till 4 o'clock the next day. Was that 4 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock?
Afternoon. Afternoon. See,
and
we should have.
What happened to you then?
We should have gone back at. We expected going forward at 2 o'clock in the morning. But the word never came through. And for all Major Kirby and Dick Ovenden tried to get through, they were driven back. There was just no way through. And they brought another mine lifting squad up. And they tried to get through. They couldn't. So we waited till 4 o'clock, and then it was decided that all was lost, I think. And we're taking out of the line what there was of us that were left. There's a few struggled back, and quite a few wounded got back. And we went back, I think somewhere near Eldarba. That wouldn't be Darba. Anyway, we went back well out the line and we had a rest. And then back to Amaria, where the rest of the battalion was, and it was being reinforced.
What was the morale of the battalion like after yet another disaster, as it appeared?
It was down a little bit, obviously. I mean, we'd lost a lot. On the other hand, Amaria was, well, it wasn't exactly a pleasant spot, but it was, you could get things, you could get places and you could get things. And of course, as soon as they got back again, we had this famous inspection, which I described before, another one, just to keep us in good form.
You've been reinforced, you said. Where were these coming from?
All over. Most of the first lot were light infantrymen, Duke of Cornwall's, Somerset's, Oxenbucks. They're from all over. I think they'd just gone round the depots and sealed could grab and brought them up and mixed them in. And you say this again was part of the problem with the attack that we'd done, that everybody was strange. Nobody, to be a good outfit, you've got to know what the next man's thinking. Well, they hadn't been there long enough to do that. I mean, for all they were light infantrymen, they still got slightly different things the way that we did them.
Were they straight out from England, or had they come?
No, I think most of them were from, I don't know. I don't remember the Oxenbucks being in the desert, but of course they might have come from Iraq or from Palestine or somewhere like that, you see. And I mean, by now, of course, they were dragging people from anywhere that could get them to ensure that the line was held at Alamein.
You lost your battalion commander.
Yes.
Who replaced him?
Well, this was a funny situation, really, because we got back to Amaria. And these reinforcements were coming in, and Colonel Major Watson came with them. He didn't know he was already the commander of the battalion. He'd been made commander on the 27th, the day the battleship had gone, and he came back, I think, about the 29th or maybe the 30th. Anyway, he'd been in command, and he wasn't there. He didn't know. He came back as a major, was a colonel when he got there.
Did this bring about any changes in the Chamber of Italian?
Not that you would notice. No. He'd been second command with Battlescombe for a while. And I suppose any changes that were to come had already come, because I think he had a good ear with... I think Battlescombe gave him a good ear all the time. And I think that any changes that he was going to make, and more or less, obviously there'd be the odd one or two things which he had at the back of his head, which were his pet theories, that he hadn't got through to Battlescombe. But I think, generally speaking, that most of the changes that had already happened that were going to happen. And I did mention before that Major Percy was now the brigade commander. I think he was a great influence on Colonel Watson. I think they were great pals, pre-war pals, because Percy had been a brigade major before the war started when Colonel Watson was a captain, I think. He might have been lieutenant. No, I think he was captain when the war started.
How long were you on airfield defences?
Quite a long time, really. Well, towards the end of August, I think the full moon was about the 28th of August. And that was the time when we expected Rommel to, if he was going to make an attack, that was the time that we thought that it would happen. And on the... On the 22nd of August, or thereabouts, 22nd, we, 151 Brigade, or the what was left of the 151 Brigade and its various bits and pieces, they went to an attack anti-aircraft brigade. Not as anti-aircraft people, but as protections for the airfield. And we moved further down the delta towards Cairo. I think we moved, 10, 15, probably midway. Was it 100 miles, I think it is, from Cairo to Alexandria? Well, probably about midway, about 50, I should think, 50 miles down towards the delta. Right in among the airfields, before we'd been on sort of the Alamein side of the airfields, just for protection in case they came through. And I mean, obviously, if there was an attack, the Air Force is going to scarp us. So what the real purpose was, I don't know. But it was paratroops that we were really worried about, was a sudden descent of paratroops and attacking airfields. But when they thought that this attack might come through again, we moved down right in the middle of the airfields and we joined an anti-aircraft division Well, one or two troops went onto the airfields themselves, but the bulk of our men were flying columns. If one airfield was attacked, we had a flying column ready to go to that particular airfield to disperse the paratroopers, obviously.
And what was the company strength?
About company strength, yes. We're only two companies then. Mind, at that time, S Company became a rifle company. Because we didn't have any carriers to mean anything, not to do anything. We hadn't been equipped to fighting equipment. I mean, when we went to do the battle with Colonel Battlescombe, we'd borrowed stuff from all over the place and pooled stuff, and that was one of those problems again. We didn't know what we were using, really. As I said before, if you get in your own car, you know if somebody's been in, more or less. You can tell things aren't just as they should be. And this was another part of the problem. One of the peculiar things about this was we had searchlights. mobile searchlights. Now, they're entirely on their own. They were stupid things, in a sense. They had an engine which drove a generator which lit the searchlight. But if you wanted to move the truck, you started the engine which drove the generator which drove the motors to to move the truck. The engine didn't drive the truck directly, it was electrically driven. And you had a panel of levers on the side to sort of give you extra power for to drop it. Not gears, but it gave it extra power to do the driving. It was a peculiar thing. And then, of course, it had the generator, really, for the searchlights. So you had this big truck that tore the searchlight out, and you coupled it up, and the searchlights and that, those days, of course, they were arcs. So it was a major job, really, to keep the arcs in trim.
An arc is
two carbon rods. And as you close them together, you get a spark going across them. So you've got to keep adjusting your sparks when you get the right amount of spark to get the best light for the reflection of the searchlight. I mean, the searchlight really is the reflectors. It's the reflectors that do the majority of the work. But the same things we use in the theatres. I mean, when I was in York, I went helping at the Theatre Royal in York on a night with, this was when I was a Remy, some nights, and they still had the arc lights there for the spotlights on the stage. And it was just a similar thing. It was two carbons in holders, and then they were screwed together, or the distance was adjusted so you got the best spark to give you the best light going up in the sky. And every now and again, depending on the use, these carbons had to be changed, which was was quite a job, because you couldn't, it had to be done cold. You couldn't do much about it when it was hot. You had to wait for it cooling down and then throw the new carbons and holders in and get some more light.
Did this extend your responsibilities?
It did, to a certain extent, yes. It was something that, I had to pick up fairly fast, because we did get some instruction, but not a great lot about it. And, of course, the searchlights were spread out over the different aerodromes. So they were on a sort of a fixed beat of going around the searchlights to sort them out through the day, generally. And at night we were doing these exercises of dashing the flying column out to protect whichever airfield was being attacked. And on occasions we had to go out with maybe a platoon, acting as paratroopers, had been dropped, enemy paratroopers, for other people to have a go at, because there was the 8th Battalion. They were on mobile columns, and the those Transvaal pioneers. There's quite a lot of South African people defending the airfields, the airstrips. There were fields, there were airstrips, landing strips mainly. Some Indians. It was quite a mixed bag. There was all sorts in this anti-aircraft division. So we'd go out now and again as paratroopers, and we'd take them out and drop them off on the edge of the airfield kind of thing, and then they'd try and get through. And we did get one or two carriers back, and we sent them out once or twice. And they went across the landing strip on a couple of occasions. The Air Force weren't very thrilled at all. they did quite a bit of damage to the airfield, and that wasn't really part of the... But it was a good exercise. I mean, it showed them what could happen if the paratroopers did land. The big problem, of course, at this time was the airfields. The Germans were after bombing the airfields. Now, when you get a bad bombing spree, you can't be certain there's not a paratroop drop going on at the same time. So it was a difficult situation to be in, and nerve-wracking a bit, because you weren't just sure where the call was going to be, what you were going to do when you got there. I mean, we're talking about in the dark, you see.
Were you bombed often?
We were bombed regularly. But fortunately, quite a lot of them hit dummy airfields, airstrips. This is obvious, that you leave some false aircraft out on a strip and you cover your own the aircraft up. I mean, this happened at Alamein as well later on, where we took tanks out in various places and blew them up through the night. We got round to having blown up tanks where you had like a big balloon, a solid balloon, similar to the aircraft balloons, and you blew them up through the night, and suddenly Germans sort of knew the tank squadron, so they'd come over and bomb that at night. But so the same thing happened at the airfields, and we had dummy aircraft out all over the place to keep them occupied. And you see, with it being moonlight at the end of this month, and the flares coming down, you felt terribly naked, because it was just like daylight on the ground. It's a funny feeling, you see, from on the top. Anybody directly above you would just see a black spot. But when you're down there and you think, oh, don't I look big, you seem stand out. But of course, from an aircraft, it would just look very small, really. And of course, Rommel did start his attack on the 30th. And he did just as it had been hoped he would do. He came round the bottom, the same as he did at Gazala. But this time we had different ideas and the tanks were dug in.
Were you involved in this at all?
No. No, we were on the airfield at the Alum Alphabet. And they came up against our tanks dug in. And the big artillery, I mean, things would change completely now. I mean, to see the artillery that went in for the Colonel Battlescombe's do, and think of the artillery that we had at, you know, if we saw a troop of artillery at Gazala, we thought we were well covered. But to see them going in for the Battlescombe attack, it was something different altogether. And of course now, it was different. I mean, there was big guns now. There was mobile 105s, which are quite big guns. I can't remember the name. There was a priest and a bishop and an archbishop, I believe.
Were you seeing these arriving?
We're seeing them going through, you see. We weren't. Every now and again we'd see them on the rail, which wasn't too far away. And if they're coming by a road, they came pretty close past us.
Montgomery had taken over this time. Was there any sense of change of purpose that reached the lower levels?
It hadn't really hit us, I don't think, that Montgomery had come. We knew he'd arrived. No, he hadn't arrived then, had he? Yes, he had. 13th of August he came, didn't he?